disability at its core is anti-capitalist and disabled people are fundamentally at odds with capitalism.
You're listening to Power from the Margins on International Day of People with a Disability.
Tune in to Power from the Margins, 3CR's broadcast for International Day of People with Disability on 3rd of December. From 7 a.m. to 7 p.m, we'll feature BIPOC perspectives, live music, artists and discussions. For details, visit 3cr.org.au/Disability Day 2019.
Hi there, you're listening to Language and Navigating the NDIS, part of 3CR's Disability Day broadcast. I'm Sibi Mako. In the next half hour, we'll focus on current language services that exist for culturally and linguistically diverse or CALD communities who need to access the NDIS. The Center for Culture, Ethnicity, and Health, or CEH, aims to train all the language interpreters in Victoria who feel that understanding the new disability system is essential to their work. CEH has trained more than 1,000 interpreters in 18 months through their Understanding the NDIS workshops. These workshops are free and advertised on Eventbrite. They have 50 language-specific and multilingual sessions in Metro Melbourne and regional Victoria. CEH has also trained bicultural workers and multicultural education aides because they are such important intermediaries between the system and families. CEH has also created resources this year to help with the training workshops. They include a glossary of NDIS and disability services in English, Turkish, Arabic, Vietnamese, simplified Chinese, and Persian, and a series of videos about discrimination and disability in Vietnamese, Arabic, and Croatian. The videos feature people who have disabilities themselves or care for someone who does. They also talk about their respective communities' reactions to them and understandings of disability. CEH has also created resources this year to help with their training workshops. They include a glossary of NDIS and disability services in English, Turkish, Arabic, Vietnamese, simplified Chinese, and Persian, and a series of videos about discrimination and disability in Vietnamese, Arabic, and Croatian. The videos feature people who have disabilities themselves or care for someone who does. They also talk about their respective communities' reaction to them and understandings of disability.
Hi everyone, my name is Tullera Lefsiniotis and I'm here with my colleague Sophie Duterte from the Centre for Culture, Ethnicity and Health.
Hi Tullera, good to be here, and while we're going to be trying to be an acronym-free zone today, we might say CEH because Centre for Culture, Ethnicity and Health is such a mouthful.
And we might even say MEA, which stands for...
Multicultural Education Aids.
Thank you. So, Sophie, could you tell us a little bit about the audio we're about to hear?
Yeah, so as you've just heard in the intro, it's an audio from a video we made with a woman from Vietnam called Kim Lee, who lives in the southeastern suburbs of Melbourne. Mm-hmm. And she has a 15-year-old son who has Down syndrome. And it's one of a series of videos we made where people who have a disability or care for someone who does talk about how their religious and cultural community has reacted to them having a disability. So we'll hear from a couple of other people in the program. But first, Kim Lee, and you can find all these videos on our Resource Hub webpage at CEH, alongside other resources we've produced.
Thank you, Sophie. Let's have a listen.
I have a boy, he's nearly 15 now, and he has Down syndrome. I have a lot of issue of the stigma and discrimination about like my family, about my son, like a disabled boy. For example, like when we first meet someone like Vietnamese people, they always like, advise me, like the boy's life thanks to the mom's morals, and the girl's is from like thanks from the dad. So try to live better, like do more charity and like helping people. You do a lot of good thing, so it have to reduce your son bad karma, something like that. Yeah, and I have another example. Like last year when I took my son to work at Springvale for shopping, and we were waiting at the daily counter to get our stuff, and there's a Vietnamese lady, she's like the same age my mom's. She start to look at my son, and after that she asked, is this boy has disease or something? I try to like pretend like I'm not Vietnamese, I don't understand. But after that she keep going, like just try to stare him and try to ask again, like this boy have the face not normal age, not like someone else, and I'm speechless. But my son suddenly, he just told me, mom, is she Vietnamese? She's speaking Vietnamese. And like at the time I just took him home straight away, and yeah, I feel really, really like heartbroken. Sometimes he asking me why people look at me like something like that. Like because the Vietnamese culture, I think it's different from another country, because Vietnam is a developing country as well. So Vietnamese people think someone like did a really, really bad thing or wrong thing in the previous life. So that's why this life, like I have a boy like disabled like that. And that's the reason why all the Vietnamese disabled kids, like infants as well, the mom and the dad of family, when they found out, or the doctor just said, your child like not normal or something, they just left at the hospital. And there's a lot of disabled children in Vietnam, like were abandoned at the hospital, church, temples, and a center for orphan and disabled children. It's really like we're not comfortable. Almost the Vietnamese parents with special children really not comfortable to like access any service. Because somebody just worry about the face, the family's reputation. About my case, like my son, I think it's really good, and he developed a lot when I sent him from the special school to the government school, I try to bring him to the community like Sigma, where I have been a volunteer to job, like to for him to, for like get him have opportunity to try to join with all the activities of the community. It helped a lot, like he much more confident in his communicating and social skill improve a lot. My advice for my community, maybe don't worry about what people think about your family and your children. Try to access the government service or any service if you can to help your children, because that all the service for them, just try to use for them because they have the right to use that. And disability is not really bad, not the worst. Like there's a lot of things worse than disabled. So don't worry about that. Just try to do as much as you can for your children.
So that was Kim Lee, who was talking about her young son who has a disability and notions in the Vietnamese community around disability. Moving on to another subject, at this point I'd like to ask you, Sophie, can you tell me a little bit about your involvement with the NDIS this year?
Yeah, so we are funded by the Victorian Department of Health and Social Services to help with the rollout of the NDIS in Victoria. And more specifically this year, we are training interpreters, bicultural workers and multicultural education aides in understanding the NDIS. And as you heard in the intro, I've trained more than 1,000 interpreters in the past year or so, and I'm aiming to train all the interested interpreters in Victoria. So we'll keep running weekly training in language or multilingual for the next until June next year.
Wow, that's a lot of interpreters, over 1,000 in different language groups.
Yes.
So why are you training interpreters? Why are you doing that?
Because interpreters, bicultural workers and multicultural education aides are all language and cultural intermediaries. Mm-hmm. So they've got different roles. Mm-hmm. Like interpreters are not there to explain. They are there to find the right words that interpret with accuracy a term or a concept, whereas bicultural workers and multicultural education aides explain, and often to newly arrived families, they are the go-to person to explain systems in their new country. So in both cases, they all need to understand the context of the NDIS, to understand concepts, and in the NDIS, those concepts can be really complex, and also to understand terminology, which in the NDIS is very technical, bordering on jargon at times, if I may say so.
Okay, very interesting. So what have you learned through doing these interpreter sessions? I understand you've helped a lot of people learn about the NDIS, but you've also learned things as well.
Yeah. Well, I learn every week, really, because every group is a different language group. Mm-hmm. And so I learn a lot from them in general. And, you know, it's very different training Arabic interpreters or training interpreters from Burma, because as participants, they're very different. Mm-hmm. But also, whether it's interpreters or bicultural workers or multicultural education aides, they're experts in their culture. Mm-hmm. And one of the things we did, especially last year, was to ask them, what are the understandings of disability in your culture? Mm-hmm. And how can they create barriers to accessing services and specifically accessing the NDIS? And look, we're very careful not to generalize, you know, just like when Kim Lee was talking before about the Vietnamese community, it's her experience of the Vietnamese community. Mm-hmm. So we're certainly not out there saying every Vietnamese person is going to do this.
Of course.
But there are things that, you know, you can... It's good to keep them in mind when you're working with people from different communities. And so the things interpreters have told us was the, and that's pretty much across all cultures, is the blame. Mm-hmm. So that often parents or the family is blamed, especially in our cultures from Asia, that it's something they've done in a previous life.
Like karma,
has caused their child to have a disability. Mm-hmm. And also the shame. So same, that's across all cultures. And, you know, across, it's same in Australia with a more, you know, long-term Australian culture, that there is an element of shame associated. And certainly in some families, a great shame associated with having a child with a disability, to the point where people might just hide that child at home and really hide the child from view. Mm-hmm. The other thing that is common across all cultures is that it's a family responsibility to look after a child, including an adult child. Mm. And, you know, Australian culture and Western cultures in general can be very individual. And you're talking about much more collectivist approach. Mm-hmm. And so it's the family's responsibility and to a point the community's responsibility. The third thing is that there is little belief in the fact that a person with a disability can still learn things and develop. And, you know, you might have a child with autism, but by engaging with the community, engaging through school, engaging with services, they might develop a range of skills that will make it easier for you as a carer and also make their life a lot more enjoyable.
Yeah.
So these things are really common to all cultures. We also asked participants to tell us about how the NDIS as a system, as a set of concepts, can be difficult for their communities. And what they were telling us was that the focus on the individual in the NDIS, you know, the NDIS is about the individual. It's about empowering the individual. It's
and
about
choice
and control.
Absolutely.
And how that really can be seen as actually going directly against community practices.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for instance, Chinese interpreters were telling us that because it's the family's job to look after someone with a disability, parents can feel quite criticized by a system that actually asks their adult child to make choices for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And the adult child might be reluctant to say what they want around autonomy, you know, around becoming more independent, because they might be afraid that their parents are going to be upset about that. So it's really complex and multi-layered.
They don't want to offend the parents.
Well, just you know, make the parents feel that they haven't done a good job. So it's really multi-layered.
Okay. So do you think these are the reasons why people from culturally and linguistically diverse, otherwise known as cold backgrounds, might be reluctant to access the NDIS? Because we know that that's not, the uptake is not so high. Is that right?
Yeah. So the cultural understandings are one of many reasons, really. As you said, only 10% of NDIS participants in Victoria are of culturally and linguistically diverse background.
Mm-hmm.
So this is versus 25% of the general community.
Mm-hmm.
So it's obviously a fairly low number, and which is why the Victorian Department of Health and Human Services has really, you know, has funded different agencies to work with those communities.
Yeah.
Other reasons are just the reasons around accessing the health system, like, you know, language barriers, complexity of the system, which is very much the case for the NDIS, not knowing that the NDIS exists. And we've been told repeatedly that because it's an acronym, you know, if you look at Medicare, we know what that means, medical care. But because the NDIS is an acronym, people who don't speak English don't understand what it is and can so easily confuse it with DHHS or
insurance schemes.
And it's an insurance scheme.
So
there's been misunderstandings around that. But also, you know, if people coming from certain countries, not all countries, might never have experienced the fact that there's a government who can provide services for people with a disability.
That's right.
So it's not just learning about the NDIS. It's just learning the whole idea that people with disability are not a burden that you carry throughout life, but there's actually services specifically for them. So it's also just integrating that knowledge. And that's not something that happens in, you know, 2 minutes.
No.
And look, the last reason is, and that's a bit technical, and I don't want to get into the technicality of it too much, but it's the restrictions around migration.
Oh, can you explain a bit how that works?
Yeah. So migration law actively discriminates against people with a disability.
Okay.
And don't quote me on the figures, but I think that's what they are, is if you want to migrate to Australia and you are going to cost more than $49,000 over the next 10 years to the public health system.
Per year?
Over 10 years.
Yeah.
Which, you know, people of my age, you know, I'm in my 50s, I'm going to cost more than $49,000 to the health system in the next 10 years.
For sure.
Just because of my age. And so that means you're basically going to cost too much.
Right.
And so you generally, you won't be able to get a visa. So that sort of eliminates all the people who come on skilled migrant visas, like, you know, a lot of people from China or from India, if they have a child with a disability, will not be allowed to migrate to Australia.
Okay.
And we hear about those families every year who are in that situation. That ban does not apply to people who come as refugees.
I see. Okay.
So as a country, we have a responsibility to offer protection to people who have a protection case, and the cost is irrelevant. It overrides any cost.
Okay.
So in newly arrived communities like the Syrian and Iraqi communities in the northern suburbs, there might be a lot of disability because of their personal history of migration, but also because there would not have been a ban against them coming here with a disability.
Okay, that's really interesting. All right, well, I guess at this point I'd like to, we're pretty much finished with our show, really. I'd just like to thank 3CR for, thank you, Sophie, that was really interesting. We are going to introduce one more excerpt, one more audio. Is that right, Sophie?
Yeah, we're going to have a couple of audios. So first we're going to hear from Aziz. So Aziz, as he will explain himself, is of Syrian background. His parents came from Syria. And he talks about his experience of having multiple sclerosis in an Arabic-speaking community.
Okay, thank you.
So about 5 years ago, I was diagnosed with relapsing remitting multiple sclerosis. At the time, I was in law school and I was studying for my criminal exam. And I first noticed certain symptoms like simple motor dysfunction, and I ignored it. Eventually, one day I woke up and I couldn't really see. And that's when my parents took me to the hospital, and after many tests and many long waiting sessions, I was diagnosed with MS, and my life turned almost upside down. In a short amount of time, I went from walking to using walking sticks, and then from walking sticks, I was soon on a wheelchair. So something that became quite apparent after my diagnosis was, how is this going to affect the perception of me from the people I'm surrounded by, from my community, specifically, you know, the Arabic community. It's very hard to paint an entire community with one brush, and so I'm very careful about stereotyping or generalizing. But the people from my community, or at least what I experienced, was a good response, a positive response, but their perceptions of me did change. So instead of perhaps being, you know, Aziz the lawyer, I became Aziz the sick person. And so there was always that danger that, you know, MS would define me. My stocks, so to speak, about marriage and, you know, my ability to provide, my ability to work, even though I actually went back to work right after the diagnosis and I wasn't supposed to. And, you know, perhaps this is old-fashioned, but from a masculine perspective, or for the point of a man, the ability to provide, especially in our community, is what the man's role is. You cannot put other people's perceptions above your own needs. And that is something that the person managing disability must factor in and must think about. Their personal needs comes before the perception of themselves from others. It just has to be put that way.
So that was Aziz, and I found that really interesting. I actually met him a year ago. He's a lovely, lovely chap. At this point, I'm going to say goodbye. I'm going to hand you over to Sophie, who will tell us a little bit about the next audio we're about to hear. I just wanted to say congratulations, 3CR, on a job well done today. 12 hours of dedicated disability radio. It's been amazing. I'd love to be a part of it again next year. Well done. Over to you, Sophie, and bye from me.
Yes, that's it. If Pauline has the energy to do this again next year, she might think never again. But ditto, ditto, I think it's fantastic. So, just a reminder that you can find the videos and our resources on our website. So it's ceh.org.au, going to the resource hub or going to our training to find the understanding the NDIS training. And you can also check on Eventbrite when the next one is. So I must say I've had great pleasure meeting all the people we interviewed for the videos, but Maisa is really fantastic. She's the next person you'll hear from. I think Maisa is a living example of how we shouldn't say disability, we should say different abilities. You know, she's blind and she is so active. She does so much, much more than most of us. And so she talks about that a little bit, but she's a great encouragement if parents want to see someone who hasn't let her disability slow her down in any way. So this is Maisa.
I'm Maisa, and I'm from the north part of Melbourne. I have sight loss, so low vision or visually impairment, whatever. So my cultural background is that My mum is originally from Italy and my father is from Egypt. But culturally and religiously, we're, my family are Muslim. The Islamic community, it's very rare that you find families or individuals that are comfortable with dogs. They associate dogs with fear, rabies, that they're gonna get sick and that the saliva is poisonous. And that they have to go run and that this dog is dirty. I guess a good example is when I was like 18, 19, when I first got my first guide dog and I was going to the program at university. And I was told that I couldn't even take my guide dog into the prayer room area. And that people that I thought were my friends were basically avoiding me on campus because I decided to have a guide dog. And then they'll say in the prayer room, hey, I avoided you in the library. I don't want to be around you and your dog. That actually happens. I guess I'm learning a lot about how people react to when I tell them that I have a disability, whether it's in the whether it's at work or around or anything. Because if I wear sunglasses, you don't know I can't see because I'm like so cool about it. Yeah, it's people that make issues around it that doesn't need to be there. Like, I'm not really a problem. You're making a problem because of. Not wanting to understand it. School was a struggle, university was a struggle, and when you have a disability, it is a lot more difficult to be able to sit in a freaking classroom, sit in a classroom, sit for your exams. It's not easy, it hurts, it's a painful process. But then it's like, you need to say to yourself that it's, you just gotta like, do the best you can, and then the rest is up to the universe kind of thing, and you've done the best you can. But when you have a disability, you do work harder. You work harder to get that job interview. You work harder to get your applications in. It is a hard gig when you're trying to be successful. And it's that's why you need to be doing things that you enjoy as well as doing things that you need to do to be able to have a meaningful life. After my work and on the weekends, I really love running and I really love playing judo. And I like going to the pool as well. I need to start doing weight training, and that's one thing I'm dreading, but I need to start doing weight training as well. So I am incredibly active, and I think that is, like when I'm running on the treadmill, my family say to me that I've got the world's biggest smile. I'm just so happy when I'm running. it's like, and I'm like, yeah, I don't know. I'm just so happy when I'm running, like doing 4-3 Ks. By then, I'm just overjoyed how I feel about my, how I feel about having this disability. Like it's just, it's only like a small part of me. It's not exactly the whole, all of me or what I am. It's only like, in the large scheme of thing, it's only like a small thing. It's just not everything.
Able-bodied Australia does not realise that people with disabilities across the board are being discriminated against. Then the government to demand that we go out and get a job without removing the disincentives like the lack of access to transport and community infrastructure, without providing accessible buildings that can provide barrier-free employment. I'm not getting a fair go and I don't like it and I'm saying so.
You're listening to 3CR, 855 on the AM dial.
The 3CR are selling kefir Palestinian scarves in support of the last factory that produces them in Hebron, Palestine. All profits will be donated to the reconstruction efforts in Gaza and support Palestinian industry. These are traditional scarves available in red and black, or you can choose from a modern design.